Welcome to Uncharted Living. We're your hosts, Christine, Rebecca, and Ty. We are life coaches who are committed to the road less traveled. Join us each week for thought-provoking and entertaining conversations, all designed to help you create your own map. Uncharted Living. It's just the beginning. Don't be afraid to get life started. Jump off the map. Welcome back. I'm so excited about today's episode of Uncharted Living. We have today a lifelong athlete, Juliette Starrett, who rode in high school and was on the UC Berkeley crew team. Go Bears.
Go Bears.
Went on to paddle, thank you, for the U.S. Women's Extreme Whitewater team, where she won 2 world championships and 5 national titles. The Starrett team founded the Ready State in 2008. And it went on to revolutionize the field of performance. Kelly Starrett is a coach, physical therapist, author, and speaker. Kelly's clients include professional athletes, Olympic medalists, Tour de France cyclists, ballet dancers, and military personnel, just to name a few. Kelly is the author of best-selling books, including Becoming a Supple Leopard, Ready to Run, Waterman 2.0, and Deathbound. Kelly and Juliette's latest book, Built to Move, is For the Rest of Us, a guide for mere mortals on how to keep our bodies in good working order. It synthesizes their deep knowledge and admiration for the human body into daily tasks that we can all do to keep us mobile and out of pain. Juliette and Kelly, thanks so much for joining us today. I've been following your work for over 10 years, so this is a really big treat for me.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks. And really, I mean, anytime we can get in a room full of brother and sister nerds, fellow nerds, we're here. Like, we're home.
Well, we are nerds, but not athletic nerds. Maybe I am an athletic nerd, but our listenership, I feel, is a new kind of Venn diagram for you guys, because it's not one of the ones you've been on with the same ultra marathoners and weekend warriors. So I'm excited to bring your message to a different population. And also, I feel like that's exactly what your book does, right? You know, I stole my wife's copy of Built to Move. I bought several copies and gave them away as Mother's Day and Father's Day.
It's working, Juliet.
It's reaching the people.
You guys managed to take all of that knowledge that I just quickly said and serve it up for mass consumption. Was this your intention? Is that what you guys meant to do? Or did you just run out of new ideas?
No, I mean, you have really done a very articulate and careful job of, you know, really pinpointing what our goal was with this book. You know, we, as you said in the intro, we've spent our early years, you know, being professional athletes and working with high performers across, you know, all sorts of realms. And at the same time, you know, we both actually turned 50 this year. We are busy working professionals, raising kids, and also ran a commercial gym for 17 years. And what we really saw is that, you know, a lot of the lessons that we were learning and applying to high performers actually apply equally to everyday people who just want to be out of pain and feel good in their bodies. And that the key for us would be, how could we actually translate that so that it would be accessible and relatable? And so I really appreciate you saying that, because that was the goal. In fact, as we were writing the book, we had a couple of moments thinking, is this too simple? Is this too simple? And we really had to be reminded often by our publisher and support team that no, it's not too simple, because again, the goal was to really step out of, you know, this vertical that we're in often, which is the, you know, very athletic, recreational athletic population, and say, hey, you know, health is for everyone. And it really can and should be demystified. And there really are a lot of very basic things that everyone can be doing that don't involve quitting your job and taking up health and fitness as a profession. So
important to understand, I think, also, is that ultimately everyone uses their body. Everyone engages in the same sets of practices. We eat food, we go to bed. It turns out that we've become really agnostic about the way that you can come to understand yourself. So with youth sports, we just see that sports, for example, happen to be a really good way to begin to unlock sort of meta awareness about how do I deal with anxiety? How do I recover? How do I manage stress? How do I manage my time? What does fueling look like? Well, it turns out high performance and like pro sports, high elite level sports is a really great laboratory. And literally maybe 15 years ago, we looked at each other and said, does it really matter that we're in the NFL? Are we just helping gladiators become gladiators so we can destroy their bodies and throw them on the fire when we're done with them? Is sport just recreation? Is it just circus? Or can sport mean more to our families? Can we use this as an opportunity to understand what good practice looks like and what's realistic for people and what is essential in sort of the care and feeding so that we could actually take sport, turn into a living laboratory, a teaching hospital, test kitchen, and then transform our communities. So that was really something that we've been hyper conscious of. And actually, don't tell anyone, but whenever we go into these high performance environments, we're just testing stuff on them. They don't know it because they win world championships in the bargain. But really, we're like, hey, this is our hypothesis. Let's run this hypothesis. So what's nice about the book is that we have a ton of data. This is all well researched, it's supported by the literature, but also we understand really how difficult it is for people to change behavior and to integrate these essential practices into a really busy life. But our goal is our family and our households, nothing else.
And if I could just add one more thing for your listeners, I'd love to bust the myth that professional athletes and serious recreational athletes are checking all the boxes and doing a great job.
No, they're super compensators.
You would be surprised to learn that when we go and work with professional athletes and teams, oftentimes they too are missing the very basics, and it may be for different reasons. You know, in many cases, it's because there are so many, technology bells and whistles and cool things that they can do that they actually sometimes skip over the basics in favor of doing all this cool technical stuff. But it turns out even those athletes and, you know, coaches sometimes get sidetracked and miss the basics as well. So, you know, we often are really working with the best of the best on the very basics. I mean, things like, hey, you should probably eat a vegetable every so often. So I just want to bust any myth anyone listening to this thinks that, you know, that the professional athlete and serious recreational athletes that are getting it right all the time. We certainly have made huge strides over the last 20, 30 years in performance in really meaningful ways. But, you know, I just don't want anyone to think that, you know, they're checking all the boxes. They're often not and need reminders to do the basics.
If you substitute in your own world, the word sport for deadline, the word competition for sick child, you know what I mean? These are equivalent stressors on the body, and your brain makes no distinction whether this is a world championship or whether, you know, you're having a hard time making ends meet this month. It is the same. So that's what we want people to understand. We want to just be easily substitute those two sort of languages and lexicons.
Well, it's so beautiful. I mean, one of the things that you talk about in your book is, and I've got it right here. I've been going through and doing these. And as someone who, like, you know, runs a couple times a week and goes to yoga and does like a pretty, quote unquote, average.
That's amazing.
attempt at, you know, health. I was surprised going through some of these exercises as just a way to check in. And for everybody listening, you know, I was surprised at what I could not do. And one of them was the breath test. We got a really low score. I don't remember what my first one was. And I've been kind of, you know, going through and checking in with these over the last few months in preparation for today. And I've improved in some of them, which is great. But, you know, breathing, right? It's one of those things where, like, I'm sure even as you're talking to some of your top athletes, that's something that we all should be doing. And, anyway, can sink into a little bit deeper, right? So these things that really apply across the board. And it sounds like you have this just holistic view of not just wanting your people to excel in whatever endeavor they're in, on a physical level, but looking at it in terms of how are they going to age then after this, right? And how does this all play into just a healthy lifestyle overall?
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Well, we became really agnostic about the way you wanted to eat, how you wanted to move. You're a vegan, you're a carnivore, you only eat bananas. Like, whatever it is that's your thing, we understand. And we actually appreciate that. There are cultural issues here. There are socioeconomic issues at play here.
Yeah.
Where you live matters, all of these things. But what you set up for us really well is that it doesn't matter. You should be able to be third-party tested, which means that if we have this sort of set of vital signs, you know, the doctor doesn't say if your blood pressure is 120 over 80, the doctor, that's not good blood pressure. It's not bad blood pressure. It's just a reference line to say, hey, I should pay attention. The doctor mm-hmm. doesn't say, well, you have to, you know, stop doing these 25 things that make you your cultural self. We can say, well, how well is your lifestyle reflected in your physiology? And so what's nice is that you can continue to do the things you want to do, but by giving people a benchmark and a clear vital sign of, hey, here's what we know about best good function of the human being for the long haul, then you can touch base. And what you realize is like, hey, maybe I could pay attention to this a little bit more, or what I thought I was doing a really great job of was leaving me a little bit short in some of these areas. Mm-hmm. And once we bring mm-hmm. awareness to it, then it's easy to be able to integrate into your life doing the things you're doing. You just need to twist these little hinges. And it turns out the little hinges open gigantic doors.
Yeah. And one of our visions here was to, and the way that you're using the book is exactly how we hope people use it, which is, you know, you visit some of the tests / vital signs, you test yourself, you do a little bit of work to see if you can improve, which I know everyone can improve on all of them, having done it myself. But, you know, the idea here was that, and why we wanted to use the word vital signs is that we almost wanted this to be like an at-home physical. Like, in fact, the word physical when you go to the doctor is actually not the right word, because there's nothing physical that they're often doing. I mean, they are looking in your ears and eyes, and every so often you'll hear of a physician doing the Solek balance test with certain people at their physical. But a lot of these other vital signs aren't really part of, you know, what we think of in a normal physical, but really can make a big difference in how you feel, how you move, how you sleep, how you sort of approach your physical life. And so what you're doing is exactly what we hope, which is that, you know, you do the test maybe initially, and then you go back and work on the things where you had some, you know, reds or yellows, and then you revisit the test, you know, a couple times a year. Like, that's kind of the idea, that it's like the kind of thing where you go back to it on the regular.
I'm interested, you guys, Juliet, you just said that, you know, you don't do everything perfectly in terms of the 10 vital signs in Built to Move. I would love to know for both of you, which one vital sign is the hardest for you to incorporate on a daily basis?
Sure, I'll go. I am really terrible at the squat. In fact, there's this ongoing joke. I know, can you believe it? Like,
no, I actually.
Yeah, so it's actually this ongoing joke, because Kelly will like pull me into videos every so often. And then like 1 second in the video without telling me, and I haven't had a chance to like warm up or stretch, he'll just go immediately into like a full, you know, ass to grass squat, which I definitely cannot do. I have like the
Weird, you're a 3-time world champion. That's
yeah, so
weird.
I have the tightest ankles known to man. I just really struggle with ankle dorsiflexion. So it's actually not my hips, it's my ankles. Mm-hmm. And so it really limits me. Like I get a yellow on the squat test. And I don't know that I'll honestly ever get a green. And I think this is important for people to understand. On that particular test, I'm a yellow, and my goal there is actually not to become a red. My goal is maybe not to become a green, because I'm 50. I probably could have, you know, spent my full-time life working on my ankle dorsiflexion in my 20s, and that would have helped me. But, you know, instead I was busy doing a sport that didn't actually require me to have full squat mobility. You know, I was paddling and rowing, and I didn't actually need that capability in order to perform at a high level. But I also know that squatting is really important as I age, being able to get up and down off the ground, having hip mobility. So for me, it's maybe one of the most important ones and something I practice a lot. And I may never reach green. I may always be yellow, but I am determined to never be red.
Let me tell you, let me give you a little insight into our home. So we live in this cool old mid-century modern house. It's called an Eichler. And in our living room, I found this device that we discovered in Korea, but I found it on eBay in North Carolina. And it's a really an old-fashioned cellulite machine. So it has walls and then a drum of spindles that rotates it.
They're like these beautiful hand-carved wood spindles.
You switch on and the thing just rotates and sounds like an industrial dryer. Like brr. And it's our ottoman because you can sit in the chair and just casually put your legs up and have someone, AKA this machine, massage your legs over and over again. And guess what's happening? Juliet's ankle range of motion is getting better.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Daily application. But really what that hints at is that many of us, you know, end up in a position or with bodies or lifestyles where it is difficult to make change. And what we're really looking at is how can I set up my life so that I don't have to be heroic in my efforts. I don't have to, you know, at the end of a long day of managing kids and business and work and laundry that I'm like, okay, and now I'm going to take care of my body. That's never going to happen. You're going to reach for a martini and, you know, and sit down in front of Netflix. So really, I think it's one thing to have this set of vital signs, which we know really underpins durability. Everyone has gotten the message you should lift a weight and exercise. But that we find that when we watch like Good Morning America or the Today Show and they have the 100-year-old people on Smuckers, none of them are weightlifters. None of them went to like Gold's Gym or P90X or, you know, boxing class. Like they're old people. And there's something about their environments that really allowed them to age gracefully and beautifully. And some of that was genetics and some of it was nutrition. Some of it is lifestyle. And so what we're trying to do here is say, how can we help you understand where you have moments of agency and control so that you can do the automatic thing without having to summon all, we want you to just use your willpower on, will I watch this movie or this movie? Will I eat this for dinner or this for dinner?
Decisions.
Not.
And I'm just going to cut you off right there because you went off on a tangent without saying the thing that you aren't good at.
Oh, was that happening?
I see what happened.
Yeah. So he's going to, I'm pushing on him. Kelly. I'm pressing his button. We're pressing his
button. Tell me, Jay, what would you say?
So Kelly's challenge vital sign is the nutrition chapter. That's what I would say is his challenge vital sign. And I will tee him up to explain it more thoroughly by saying that he actually, despite his large size, can't actually eat very much in one sitting. Like I can actually eat more in a single sitting than him. He has this little like mini stomach for a large man. Is that fair to say?
Sure.
And so
it's not emasculating. I'm fine.
So he often, you know, he really has to make sure that he eats more. We're not big snackers and we really just kind of try to stick to like, we eat three meals a day and we don't want to be eating all the time.
Yeah.
But you know, in his case, he does need to eat more often because he's not able to actually eat that much in a sitting. And so if we get busy at work or get behind, you know, he often will get home at 6 PM and he has grossly undereaten for the day. And then he's got to catch up at night, which then of course isn't good for his sleep, but he can talk more about it. He also has done an experiment with intermittent fasting that didn't work out great for him. So take it away.
Wow. Okay. Look, one of the vital signs in the book is that we're trying to get people to eat enough protein. And one of the reasons we see that is that that protein is your gut. It's your brain. It's this connective tissue of your skin. And if you want to have healthy, robust mechanical systems and a digestion system, et cetera, you have to have enough protein. And oftentimes we see that people really flirt with the minimum protein requirement so that you don't get sick. That's what the RDA are. Like if you get this much vitamin D, you don't end up with rickets. If you get this much vitamin C, you don't have scurvy. So understand that those RDA recommendations aren't for health. They're like your doctor says, well, you're not, you know, your hematocrit is not that. I mean, you're in the functional range, but you know, I'm sorry you get out of breath going upstairs every day. So ultimately, what we're trying to realize is that, hey, we think that most people can benefit from eating more protein. Notice that we didn't say what kind of protein or how or when or whatever you want to do. That's up to you. But one of the benefits of eating more protein we have found is that it creates high satiety, and that when people eat, our two recommendations mm-hmm. of the book for nutrition are to eat 800 grams of fruits and vegetables every day. And if you're like, I only eat pineapple, great. We'll take 800 grams of pineapple every day. 1.7 pounds is what 800 grams is. And 1.8 pounds of melon is 230 calories or 280 calories. So it turns out these very nutrient dense foods that we're asking people to eat, more protein, more fruits and vegetables, end up making us very full. And mm-hmm. they cover all our micronutrient fueling plus nutrition needs on the protein side. And what we get in there is some of what we call adult calorie control. So if I like cookie is my jam, like cookies, I have a thing for cookies, and I really will never let an orphan cookie just exist in the world.
Any kind of cookie, truly.
I want everyone to understand. I love cookies. And if there's cookies in the house, it doesn't matter. I'm in. Okay. I'm agnostic.
I need to know.
I'm a pantomantic cookie eater. And if there are cookies in the home, I'll wake up at 2 a.m. and like no one is safe in my house until those cookies are gone. I have to be really careful about bringing cookies in the house.
Got it. But
if what we find though is like a Starbucks cookie is 280 calories or 350 calories. And so it's easy to end up eating these nutrient non-dense foods.
To overeat them.
That's right. Right. And so what ends up happening is that for me, I really struggle to get enough protein every day, as Juliet said. And so that's something I'm constantly working on. And what's nice about having a benchmark for people is that a lot of people, the only reason they're interested in nutrition is for weight loss. And I think that's totally valid. We see this as a spectrum. For my kids, I want them to have all the things they need on board to grow. For Juliet and I, we just want to be durable and I want to be less gross for my wife. That's one of my kind of goals, less gross.
Good goal.
And calorie control is a way of managing my body composition so that I feel good and that my wife thinks that I'm still attractive. And one of the ways I can do that is by eating a lot more whole foods. So, but as we see having this sort of benchmark, it means it's really up to me about how I want to solve that problem. So people may have heard of intermittent fasting or time restricted eating. Mm-hmm. It turns out maybe it wasn't great for us because we were seeing people lose a lot of weight, but because they weren't eating, they were losing a lot of lean muscle mass. Mm-hmm. So the research came out that maybe it's a really good way for calorie control, but in the wash, we were losing a lot of essential muscle. And as everyone knows, especially past 50, it's hard to put muscle on. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to lose muscle if we don't use it. So I thought, hey, I'll try this adult calorie control restriction thing because this is cool. I don't really feel hungry.
Everybody else is doing it.
Right. And what I found was I was deeply under caloried by the afternoon and starving, and my workout sucked. And then literally at midnight, I'd wake up and I'd be like, wow, I'm starving. Let me eat a chicken, a jar of peanut butter, and a sleeve of Girl Scout cookies to try to make up for the calories. And I don't know if you know that, but that's not a great diet right there. And then I'd eat that in the middle of the night and sleep like crap. Wake up the next morning and be like, let's go fasting again. So, you know, I quickly saw it. Wait a minute. I'm not meeting my minimums on anything. It's wrecking my sleep. I'm eating like crap. Maybe this isn't a strategy that works for me. Because once I had some guidelines, then I was really able to fit in the things that felt important to me and to my family into those guidelines.
And I'll just add, since we've gone a little deep on this nutrition piece, I mean, I don't know about you two, but you know, I probably started in sort of like diet culture in college, and I was
drinking.
You know,
tab.
I was a Division I athlete following the fat-free diet, which I think is so hilarious. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I was like, sweet, I can have a plain bagel and a mocha for breakfast after a 3-hour rowing practice, and I killed it because it was fat-free. I mean, like, it just, I look back and I think, man. You know, and then it's, you know, I've tried every other diet fad that's come out. And look, for anyone listening to this, if you've, you know, all of these diets are effectively calorie control tools with sort of a different dress on. That's the way to think of them. They all are. It doesn't matter whether it's keto or paleo or the Mediterranean diet or the zone. I mean, you name it. These are all ways of intermittent fasting, calorie control. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. If people listening have found a way to eat that works for them,
killer.
I have zero judgment there.
Except, like, are you getting enough micronutrients?
Yeah, no judgment.
And protein, right?
But mm-hmm. in the end, if one of the goals isn't just calorie control, if the other goal is health and, you know, physical durability, which has become of the utmost important to us at our current age and as we age, you know, I think it's just important to do a little evaluation. Are you getting enough protein? Are you eating enough micronutrients? And one of the things we love about this way of eating is, you know, unlike sort of the restrictive nature of so many eating styles, it's very expansive and it allows you to be normal. Like, you can go to a dinner party with your friends and not be like the weirdo who can't eat this 17 things and you're restricted here and restricted there. You can go out to dinner with your family. You know, you can eat like the same things your kids might eat for dinner, like, go figure. So it just, you know, it's just expansive and allows you to just enjoy food. Which is one of the great joys of being a human, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And you're also talking to two life coaches. So that is absolutely part of what I received from your book is, like, these are great benchmarks. These are great vital signs to check in with that will set you up really to feel great. But there is an expansiveness to it. And there is this element of, like, do what works for you. And so much of what we do in one-on-one sessions with clients is, like, they're trying to follow someone else's protocol, right? Like, they've been trying to live their life based on what their mother-in-law wants, what, you know, just these ideas we have of how we're supposed to be operating. And this is a really beautiful way to incorporate that physical component that, you know, it really goes hand in hand with some of the other ambitions and goals folks might have. These are vital signs that really set you up for, you know, I don't enjoying life, right? I mean, all of this is around quality of life and the longevity piece. And I think you both really explain that so well.
One of the things that I want to just double click on that you said there is this quality of life piece. And what ends up happening when we sit down with other people and eat dinner, magic happens. The research is that we eat less and we feel more connected and we make better food choices and we digest our food better because we eat slower. And, you know, one of the things that happens underneath a lot of the vital signs of this book is that we end up inadvertently driving this thing called human connection, which is so annoying. And, you know, I'll call this phenomenon, for example, the Steve effect. We have a neighbor that we battled with a fence a while ago, and it made some animosity between our households. And, you know, he and his family did not like us, and we did not like him because of this fence, as it happens. And everyone can relate to having a persnickety neighbor. But I have to see Steve all the time. Because we walk and Steve walks. He walks his dog and we walk our dog and we have a walk in the evening and we see our friends and I'm like, hey, Steve. And he's like, hey, Kelly. And we're like, hey. And I tell you what, if you want to de-escalate neighborhood fences, just run into your neighbor 1,000 times outside. And really, that's a way of creating civil society where we see our neighbors because we're outside, that we make time to eat with our families and friends, that going outside gets us more sunlight. So suddenly what we find is that a lot of these behaviors inadvertently stack and they're tightly coupled. And what's difficult, I think, to conceptualize is how all of these behaviors work in symphony to create a greater whole. And I think that's what you saw with my example, my silly example of time-restricted eating was that it affected my sleep. And we don't necessarily think about nutrition affecting sleep, but there you go. You know, Juliet has found out that if she eats within a couple hours of bedtime, her sleep is trashed. She would be better off having a big margarita before she went to bed than eating a dinner, like a huge meal right before. Like, it has a bigger impact on her body. I know. Yeah. That's what I said.
Yeah. It's amazing. So, yeah. I mean, even just last night as an example, you know, our daughter played a late water polo game, which I'm sure all the parents listening to this can relate. Like, you have a sporting event that, like, makes dinner weird. You know, you either have to eat dinner at like 4 o'clock or 9 o'clock, right? I'm sure many parents can relate to this. And totally. So we had, you know, the pendulum swung to the opposite end and we couldn't eat dinner until 8:45. And then because, you know, I'm obsessed with sleeping, I was like already laying down by 9:45 or 10. And, you know, I just didn't sleep that well. My sleep was a little bit messed up because I went to bed with a full stomach. And it's just those kinds of decisions. And sometimes you can't, right? Again, it's not as though I'm going to miss my kid's water polo game in order order to make sure I eat my dinner right at 6:30. You know, again, this is about like, you know, maybe the 80% rule is the best way to think about this. I mean, I think that's really how we live our lives. But when
you have a vital sign, you can come back to
it. Yeah. And we just always come back. Okay. So right. I had to eat too late last night. Wasn't ideal. My sleep wasn't ideal. Tonight, I know I can control when I have dinner. I don't have an evening function. I can, you know, eat at a normal time, go to bed at a normal time. And I think part of that is just, you know, again, with this vital sign idea, benchmark is like giving people a little bit of grace to say, okay, life is crazy. And, you know, these are the goals, but man, it's not like you failed if you didn't hit it today or tomorrow. And it's just, you know, these are the things to keep an eye on physically and keep coming back to when you can, and keeping an eye on them, just like the way I'm keeping an eye on my squat so that I keep what I've got.
Be consistent before you're heroic.
And that it lines up so perfectly with our major, you know, banner for life coaching is not every day is going to be perfect. And turtle steps, like did you do a little bit better than yesterday? Great. If not, okay, try again. So it's the consistency that you guys are talking about that I think really resonates with our audience in terms of we're in a long distance.
Yes.
Right.
Seriously, you know, crushing consistency.
I don't know if your audience will relate to this, but I love to think of this in like financial terms, right? Like it's like, you know, I think about things in the aggregate, right? And so each one of these habits, you know, if you miss it on one day, who cares, right? You know, you can, if you start to, you know, go out by a week, by a month, and you look at the averages and you think, okay, you know, I got 2 days ago, I could only get 5,000 steps because I had a crazy day. And then, you know, I got 12,000 steps one day, and sweet, I'm averaging it out at a decent number that I feel good about. And I think if you take every single physical habit that we have in this book and think about it in those terms, it really makes it okay when you have to travel for work or you have a sick kid or a stressful deadline, and realize that the few days where you can't do the things you know you need to do isn't going to impact you in the long term. It's all about that consistency.
Let me give you an example that will freak you out a little bit. We work with a sedentary researcher named Mark Benden, who's out of Texas A&M.
Yep.
And he worked with a lot of fourth and fifth grade classrooms to see how well and how a different teaching environment, learning environment changed the physiology of the kids. They looked at energy expenditure and time on task and happiness, reported feelings of safety. One of the things they noticed was that this age group tends to add 1% on their body mass index every year. So it's actually 1-2%. So between fourth and fifth grade, kids get a little heavier year after year. And one of the things that he put in was, hey, what happens if we just give kids more movement autonomy? We move to a standing station where they can lean and perch and fidget and get up and down, and they have movement choice versus sort of our traditional setup classrooms. And in those fourth and fifth grade, especially over 2 years, this is a 2-year project, they found that those kids lost an average of 1-2 body mass percentage points over 1-2 years. So over 2 years, what you see is a delta, a change of somewhere between 2 and 4 body mass index points for a young person. And that's, I think, what's tricky for us as humans is we're living now, but we don't see how all of these small behaviors aggregate over time. And here we have the only difference is kids have more movement choice in their classrooms. They are more physically active instead of just sitting in a chair being lectured to. And over the course of 2 years, that's a delta of 4 percentage points in their body mass index. That's a lifetime. You know how hard it is to change 4 index points? Yes, I do, because I'm a big person. I get it. So, I mean, this is the idea I think that you're hinting at, is that we sometimes can't see how all of these things interact, and they certainly can't see how they interact over a lifetime. It's just hidden from us.
I've got one other little cool data point on this, if I can share. We just had Dan Buettner on our podcast, and he is the Blue Zones guy, and people may have heard of him because he just had a documentary come out. And one of the reasons I'm a fan of his work is he's actually trying to work at the population level to make change. He's working with cities and communities to try to really implement very small changes like adding sidewalks and you know, some things that just you know, create a little bit more movement choice for people. But they did a project with the city of Fort Worth, Texas. And just by making a few minor changes to their city environment, they were able to track and see that the BMI of Fort Worth, and I'm not sure if they were measuring city employees. I think it was city employees. Just the city employees BMI went as a group down by 1 percentage point only. So not that much, 1 percentage point. But it saved them $270 million in healthcare costs. Mm-hmm. And so you just see that it's like, you know, people aren't all losing 250 pounds. They're not, you know, they're not having these extreme changes. They're just making slight changes to their days, slight changes to their environments. It's making a small difference in their BMI, small, not major, small, and having this huge positive impact in how people's, you know, health outcomes are turning out. And so I just think it's really important to think about that as you know, anyone listening to this is like, how do I approach this individually? And I think we've all said it 5,000 times, but it's like, man, just the little teeny changes done consistently over time really do add up.
Yeah, there's like a number of things from your book that I want to talk about. And it's what you just said is bringing them all to the forefront in my brain. But I think two things. The first thing is this concept, Juliet, that you're talking about, where we can incorporate these small changes on like the daily basis, where we're not asking people, you're not asking people to go climb Mount Everest or do anything. You're just saying incorporate something into your day that allows you to, you know, move a little bit more, right? Because our bodies are naturally designed to do that.
Or move a little differently.
Yeah.
Move a little differently. Great. Thank you. The thing that you highlighted in the book, there was a story you told about your succulent that was like in a storage unit for a really long time. Then you pulled it out. But it was this idea, and we love plants. You can see Ty has like a million plants behind her. The idea was in that story that you told so beautifully was like, it's not really too late, you know, to incorporate some of these things in a small way. And I, as life coaches, that's also what we always want to be offering, is that even a small thing can make such a difference. And you might not see it today, but you will start to feel it over the course of weeks and months. And so these things are all really accessible.
Yeah. You know, one of our missions here, and we've talked about this on other podcasts, is to try to break people of the perception that physical activity always has to happen in 1 hour blocks. Mm-hmm. I think people would be surprised if they really sort of did some self-discovery to realize that we often all as humans have, I think we've been so conditioned to think that exercise happens in 1 hour because all exercise classes are that length of time, and that we all sort of believe that unless it's an hour, it's not worth it. And I'm hoping, you know, we're really hoping to blow that up and have people let that go out of their minds, because there is so much you can do in 2 minute, 5 minute, 10 minute increments. And again, if you think about it in the aggregate, you know, when I think about my own walking practice, for example, you know, my goal is always to get 8,000 steps a day, like Built to Move suggests. And I don't ever go for a 1 hour walk at any point in the day. I've just figured out little ways to accumulate steps here and there throughout my day. And I think I really hope people can start to rethink that and realize that, you know, I'll give you an example of your breathing, right? People listening to this may also struggle with the breathing test and not do great, but nobody listening to this is then going to be like, okay, great. Well, I didn't do well on the Built to Move breathing test. I'm going to sign up for a 1 hour breathing class. Nobody has time for that. Like, let's be honest, right? Zero people are going to go do that. It sounds cool. But maybe, you know, people listening have a job or something. So what we've really tried to say is man, so many of these little acts, I would say, can be done by rethinking your environment. So it makes it easy to do them without thinking. That's sort of figuring out ways to change up your environment and be really changing how you think about what counts. Because I do think we've been told like you have to be breathing, you know, bleeding out your eyes and sweating and laying on the floor after your workout for it to count. Well, that's not true. If you accumulate lots of little movement snacks throughout your day, those all count. And in the aggregate really count. And so I think it's, you know, I think that's what we really try to do is say, okay, look, nobody's going to go to a breathing class, but we are hoping you're going to spend 10 minutes on your living room floor at night doing mobility work. And that's a great way to practice and incorporate breathing. So we're trying to think about helping people figure out how to stack these behaviors. Or if you are going for a little 10-minute walks here and there, that's another great time to practice your breathing. So, you know, again, it's blow up the 1 hour workout and figure out ways you can, you know, stack these behaviors with one another so that, again, you can fit it into a busy life.
Julia, you were recently in DC advocating for women's health. I want to know more about that. Our listeners definitely want to know more about that. Can you tell us what you were doing there?
Sure. I mean, you know, I will say it's the first time I've worn a suit since I was a lawyer back in the olden days. So that was
when
I had to buy a suit because I don't have one anymore. And I just wear spandex all the time. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of fun. You know, I was really honored to be invited to be part of this congressional panel advocating for women's health in the military in particular, although to the extent that there's going to be any policy change around this, I think it will positively impact all women. But you know, the backstory I find to be really interesting and relates to this conversation. We're actually at a point in history where 70% of 18 to 22 year old boys physically cannot qualify to join the military. And there's a variety of reasons for that. Yep, 70% do not qualify to join the military. That's for a variety of reasons: obesity, lack of physical skills, opioid addiction, prison. There's a lot of reasons, but it's 70%. And at the same time, women are having a heyday. Girls are outperforming boys in all metrics, from graduation rates to college admissions to standardized tests, which, you know, as like a girl mom, I kind of want a fist bump in the air, but ultimately is actually terrible for our culture, right? We want everyone to do well physically. And so the military is particularly focused on how to make the military more accessible to more women and how to really focus on changing the standards so that you don't need to be a 7-time Olympian to pass the physical standards of the military. Even doing things as simple as making sure the uniforms are designed to fit women. The backpacks are designed to fit women. I mean, they're going, you know, like, you know, a mile wide and very deep on this. And it's really interesting because I think, you know, to the extent we think of the military as like a little mini version of our culture at large, I think a lot of these changes are going to have, you know, a big, you know, big impact on our culture generally and are great. But I think the underlying reason for it is pretty scary, right? I mean, I think it's great that we're doing this amazing work to create more opportunity for women. But the reason for it is a bit scary, I'll be honest.
Wow. That number is shocking.
Yep. Yeah, it really is. Wow. And it's, I think the thing that people don't think about is it's a national security concern because, you know, the military is now able to forecast out into the future and see that really key important roles are going to not be filled with physical humans, you know, in the near and far term. And so, you know, it's a concern. And I do think I'm hopeful as well, though, because I think regardless of whether the focus is on the military, you know, if military readiness is the reason, that maybe more focus is brought into physical education for kids, like I'm all for it. Right. You know, I mean, one example I'll give, and I actually talked about this at the congressional panel, but you know, we all have done the president's physical fitness test. Do you guys remember that? Did you do that at your own school? Mm-hmm. Well, that test,
flexed arm hang.
Yeah, the flexed arm hang. That test was created by JFK to make sure kids were physically fit enough to join the military. Mm-hmm. It wasn't some like, let's create general physical fitness. It was so kids were fit enough to join the military. And what's weird now is kids still do the physical fitness test, except they don't do anything in PE class to prepare them to do well at the physical fitness test, right? Like they play soccer and then are tested on the flexed arm hang, which has like zero correlation. Right. And so, you know, my hope, and I said, hey, look, what are we talking about? Like, how are we going to have military readiness if we don't encourage movement in our, you know, elementary, middle, and high school age kids? And you know, lots of movement at that and good physical education programs. So my hope is that out of this will come an improved focus at a policy level on reinvesting in movement and physical education for kids because they need to be ready for the military, fine. I don't really care what the end goal is. If it means that we spend more money and time and effort on physically well kids, like, I'm all for it.
And Juliet brings up something I think is worth talking about, is where's the functional unit of change in society, in our culture, in our country, in our neighborhoods? It's the household. And if we start to look at where and what the household portends, there's a lot of children in the household. So that's where we're going to learn to eat, where we're going to learn to sleep, we're going to learn to self-soothe, where we're going to talk about our feelings or not. Thanks, Starrettes. And or we're going to learn to take care of our bodies. And, you know, we see this sort of echoed over and over again. There was a time when I was working in the NFL, and they were talking and lamenting that all the kids that came out of college were injured already. And I was like, oh, it's the college. So I work in a lot of colleges, and I was like, hey, what's up with you guys hurting all these NFL players? And they were like, it's not us. We had 22 of our 24 All-Americans had knee pain doing an air squat. And I was like, it's the high schools. So I go over to the high schools, because we work in a lot of high schools, and they're like, these kids from middle school have no movement skills. And you're like, yeah, oh, it's the middle school. Yeah. So as we worked our way back, and that same thing was reflected even with, you know, the first time we kind of became interested in looking at the work environment as a place, an agent for change, we were at Google doing a talk about their workforce health, because they were having tons of back problems, all these repetitive stress injuries, and they were throwing so much money. They're like, we can't get enough of the right mouses and get people in the right perfect positions. I was like, yeah, it's misplaced precision. So we did a talk in Google, and then turned around and we're like, wow, our kids are sitting way more than the Google people are sitting. So that what we ultimately see, as Juliet's saying, is that we want to change where and when this happens. And the most important place is the household.
Speaking of which, I really want to know, you guys both have teenagers now. How have you parented differently than everybody else has been?
Man, I mean, I will say that it's really, I will add, I'll start by saying it's really hard to be a parent.
It's a hypothesis too.
Yeah. And, and you know, we always say anyone who thinks we've done a good job, we're like, hey, come back and talk to us in like 8 more years, because this is really an experiment we're running, and we will, you know, we'll see. But, you know, I think a couple of things that we did differently, or that we prioritized our kids' sleep and teaching them how to sleep from the very beginning. Our kids have no sleep issues. They can self-soothe, put themselves to bed, sleep for a long time. They value sleep, care about sleep. So we really prioritize that from the very beginning. And in fact, when we were little, we used to kind of laugh, because like, people would say to us, wow, your kids are so well behaved and like they're friendly and nice. And we would laugh to ourselves, because we're like, man, we are, I'm sure, messing them up in 1,001 ways. But the only thing we know we did right is make sure they were well slept. And, you know, we protected their sleep. And, you know, we were kind of militant about sleep when they were really little. But we felt the benefits in that our kids, when they were awake, were lovely. They weren't upset. You know, they were well-behaved and lovely to be around. And that wasn't anything other than they were well-rested, period. End. Like, had nothing to do with our parenting. It was just that they slept well. So I think we super prioritize their sleep and continue to do that throughout their teenage years too. I mean, you know, teenagers' sleep schedules really change. They do become more nocturnal. They want to stay up late. You know, it's a constant battle with the phone situation. So we're in it as well. But still, somehow our kids both love sleeping and prioritize it. And so that's number one. And then number two, like Kelly said, we have set up our household to be as movement rich as possible. So we have a home gym, and that doesn't need to be, by the way, any crazy investment. I mean, for a long time, we just had like one of those pull-up bars that went in between the doors that we got on Amazon for $24. You know, we have balance boards and skateboards and frisbees around and things to play with and balls and, you know, like a pull-up bar right by the door of our garage. So we've just really tried to set up our house so that it is really encourages a lot of play and movement. And again, play and movement without having to try that hard, because it's like right there, you're like, oh, this balance board is in the middle of my living room. I guess I'm going to get on it right now. So I think those are the two things that we've really done, is really prioritize and focus on sleep, and then make our household a play movement centered, sort of spaceship, I would say.
I'll add that we lucked out into sort of understanding nutrition as a performance advantage. and as a fueling way. And so being able to sort of talk about it, nutrition as fuel, and that mm-hmm. one of our friends, Sean Stevenson, recently kind of coined the term kitchen culture. And we have a kitchen and meal culture in our house. And so we sit down together most nights and always have, even if it's a 20-minute like fake dinner, you know, chili that's been in the crock pot, we sit down and eat together. And that, putting that family connection around food together, I've continued to make breakfast for the women in my family for as long as I can make breakfast, you know, and that's partly because we come together for a few minutes in the morning and we get to chit chat, and partly because I get to control what they eat for breakfast. You know, with Caroline, she gets a couple fish oil tabs, she gets a little vitamin D, she gets a little kefir, she gets a vitamin C emergency. I make her a protein, she eats three pieces of fruit and maybe a bagel. Then I'm like, all right, kid, I don't know what's going to happen the rest of the day, but at least you just left here.
She made Takis for the rest of the day at school, but it's right? Mine. Like,
so in those situations, what we saw was there are places where we had some control and agency around not giving them the choice. Because I mean, Caroline would just love to eat pizza.
Yeah,
and,
I mean,
you know,
I think that's an important thing that we do. We have two very different kids. Our daughter Georgia is like, will eat literally anything and has this like amazing diverse palate. And then Caroline, I'm sure many listeners can relate, left her own devices, would exclusively eat brown food. So she's our challenge, right? She's the one that it's like, man, we have to just kind of be on it all the time. And our strategy is to control what we can control, right? We make sure there's fruits and vegetables and protein at breakfast and dinner. And, you know, we've, you know, taught her about pre-game and, you know, sports nutrition. And then during the day, you know, we have to be like, well, hope for the best. And maybe what she ate at school today was Takis. But, you know, again, when you think about it in the aggregate, it's probably not going to, it's not going to kill her, you know?
You know, Juliet says, she says, you know, people do two things. They move together and eat together. That's really what we do. And so I think we went out of our way. We live in Northern California. Our kids are white. They have a lot of privilege. You know, Juliet and I were children of single working mothers, so we had a little insecurity in our family, and we love not having insecurity now. And I think one of the things that we really tried to do was make our kids uncomfortable. We're going to spend a lot of time in the wilderness. We're going to be uncomfortable. We're going to go travel whenever we can and sleep in strange places and eat weird foods and be times lagged and have to interact with lots of different kinds of people. And I think rinse, wash, repeat over a long time, and we'll see what happens. You know, we really like to hang out with our kids, and we think we just sent our oldest to college, and we're sort of watching to see. Is it
work? We're like, did it work? Like, did any of this stuff work? Like, you know, we're sort of like, is she, you know, like, we're like, is she exercising on her own without us telling her? Like, what's she eating in the dining hall? Right. So, I mean, man, the experiment is live. So we'll report back.
Well, she's ongoing. In Michigan, right? So
kitchen culture, food culture, everybody.
That's going to be interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. So we'll report back.
Look at those three blocks that we ended up sort of settling on. How do we eat as a family and talk about food and make food a center place for us to connect? You know, how do we protect sleep? I mean, our daughter our youngest is a sophomore, and she's a superstar water polo goalie. Like, she has a knack, but she's been putting herself to bed at 9:30. She sleeps till 7:00, 9:30 to 7:00. She's 15 years old. And she's like, yeah, when I sleep, it's just, everything's better. And you're like, holy moly. So, you know, and then moving, and we don't care what you want to do. You want to do dance, want to do yoga, it doesn't matter, but the movement isn't a choice. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, we're lucky as a generation that we did not have TikTok and Netflix and all these things, because I'm sure I would have been like, nah, I don't need to move. It's fine. You know, I would have self-soothed in a different way. Juliet and I both, I think, had a little anxiety as children, and we learned to self-medicate with movement and sport. And so by giving our kids choice, are you doing gymnastics or soccer? Are you doing swim team or X? Like, you don't have a choice which one you're going to do, because learning to move and learning to love how that feels is very much an acquired skill, unless you have exercise ADD like we do.
Well, and I think that that's a really important point for any parents listening to this. You know, what I've seen in my own friends who, you know, they're now in their 40s and 50s is those of them who didn't find a way to move their bodies when they are young, they've really struggled to figure out how to fit in exercise into their lives much more than those of us who did. Mm-hmm. And so I do really encourage people to you know, employ the movement isn't a choice. What kind of movement is a choice? When we told our kids, like, sky's the limit. You know, if you want to do martial arts or swim team or, I mean, you name it, like dance, any kind of movement was fair game, but not moving. The only choice was not moving. It was what movement to do. And we really wanted to give them this wide opportunity. They both did ballet and gymnastics and they tried, you know, martial arts. And so they really were able to find things they love doing. And I think that's an important gift to give to your kids, is to give them that opportunity to find a form of movement that they like. And, you know, even for arty kids, I will say, because one thing I notice is that sometimes kids get bucketed. They're like, my kid is either sporty or arty. And, yeah. and you don't need to be both. Even the kid who's the, you know, amazing drummer, that kid still needs to move throughout their life. It's not, it, that isn't just left. It shouldn't be left for the, just the kids who identify as sporty, because mm-hmm. there's so many cool ways to move that don't, that aren't team sport, that, you know, aren't competitive. There's just cool ways to move your body. So I think, you know, encouraging kids, every kid, regardless of what their interests are, to find a way that they like to move their body is really important.
Caroline is a maker. And right now she's in a heavy crochet rotation.
Oh,
and
fun.
She's crocheting herself a sweater right now, which is bananas. Just freestyling. I just, you know, she's freestyled this sweater, but she'll sit for 4 hours and crochet. And she's like, I think I have an overuse injury in my wrist, Dad. And so understand, her best friend is also a fine arts major at the local art high school and is a great soccer player. And we want people to understand that you don't get to choose brain or body. You have to choose both. And it doesn't have to be heroic. Did you breathe hard? Did you sweat? Did you play Frisbee? You know, I think the pandemic really highlighted that as a industrial fitness complex, we had really failed people. That if you go onto the internet today, all I see on my Instagram is people who won fitness. That day, their abs are shredded, they're tanned.
They look amazing, they have in a bikini meal prep, all the time.
And I was like, oh, you guys won. You won the World Championship of Fitness. Congratulations. Enjoy your retirement. You know what I mean? Because where do you go from here? And what we saw, I think, was that we had a whole generation of adults who did not know how to take care of themselves. And we're still seeing particularly opiate use, alcohol use, marijuana use through the roof at record levels. And what is that about? That's about people trying to make themselves feel better. That's all it is. It's self-soothing. We don't have any, attachment to that. We're just saying that, wow, we're trying to get out of our brains because we're feeling some anxiety or we're not feeling good. These are ways to feel better. Mm-hmm. And when we saw people suddenly gain 15 pounds in pandemic, it was because we didn't teach people how to take care of themselves. And so if we look at obesity or depression or substance abuse or injuries, literally every one of those metrics is tracking in the wrong direction. So if I turn around and look at the industrial fitness complex, Juliet, what I can say is you have failed society. And we're part of this. So we own, like, what part of the failure is ours. And simultaneously, one of the things I think we're very proud of is that our kids know how to go to a gym and what to do. Mm-hmm. We've taught our kids how to exercise and move their bodies in the same way that our kids know how to cook a meal. They know how to prepare themselves to go to sleep. And the whole thing is a test. You know, your test is your life. Mm-hmm. Were you prepared? And for some of us, we came out of traditions of families that did not prepare us. Our parents didn't have the tools. They didn't learn it somewhere. And so we may be the first generation that has to teach ourselves what it is to be a physical, psycho-emotional, healthy person.
Yeah. And I think for everyone listening too, I mean, what you said is so beautiful. We might have to teach ourselves these things, but we have resources now.
Oh yeah.
And it's not too late. And there's always something we can incorporate into our daily activity that will help us feel better, will help us sleep better, help us get those nutrition, the macros and the micros, right, that we need to feel great and just live happily, really, at a baseline, right?
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
We'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I feel like we could keep talking to you both for forever. I have so many questions. One of the things I did want to ask as we get near our end here is, you've been interviewed a million times and, you know, part of our whole thing is like living uncharted, right? Where we really try to take the path that might put us into a new zone, right? And a lot of our clients are learning how to do that. And we're guiding them in that process. But is there a piece of this? I feel like you both, what's one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is because you've been doing this for a really long time. You've been living that way. And so I really want to just ask the question, you know, is there anything that no one's asking you in these interviews that you want to talk about or anything that you want to say in the minute we have left with you? We want to mine you for your wisdom in living so uncharted.
I mean, I don't know that we have never been asked this, but I really think that our goal here and with Built to Move and sort of our new focus as professionals is just to try to blow up some of the myths that have been created around what it means to be healthy and try to expand and invite way more people into this conversation. And so, you know, that's what I'm interested in now. And I think, you know, part of the reason I was so honored and thought it was so cool to go to this congressional panel is, you know, I think athletes are cool and making athletes better is cool and sexy. But really, I think, you know, my personal mission is just to invite more people into this conversation that we all should be able to own health. We should all have access to health. A lot of it can be done on our living room floor with our family and our friends around us. And that, you know, it's a myth that, you know, it's just for the people who identify as athletes or, you know, or were athletes in college or high school or whatever. So I guess that's kind of that's sort of my own mission that I'm on. Right. I don't know. What would you add?
Thank you.
I end up having to blow up a lot of preconceived notions when people come to work with me. They're in pain or they've been injured. And Julia has this thing. She's like, you may just be an average physical therapist, you know, but she's like, but you're really good at giving people permission to own their health and their response and their healing and their movement. I think that's sometimes what we all need is just a little pat on the back and say, hey, you're not going to mess it up. You can't mess it up. It's all net positive and additive. I think when we commoditize it and wrap it up and put all these boundaries and fences around it and make it so that like you stepped off the curb wrong. Now your pelvis is off. I mean, like, do you know what human beings are capable of? I mean, we are the most robust, hardy, capable beings on the planet to our detriment. Like, you can eat little chocolate donuts and chain smoke and win a world championship. So if that's the case, let's use that to our advantage of saying, hey, I don't ever have to play a perfect game. I just get to play every day.
I love it. Thank you both so much. You have a podcast. You've got Built to Move, this book we've been talking about. You've got an app. Digital classes, all of this are available at the Ready
State. I'm exhausted just saying that.
I mean, it's amazing. It's impressive. And for someone who is just newly tuned in to what you're doing, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for breaking it down in this way for those of us and everyone listening at home who doesn't fall into the, you know, sporty spice zone, right? All of the time. So I really want to thank you. It's a gift that you're giving to the world. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you. And I just want to say, we do have a free 21-day Built to Move challenge at builttomove.com for anyone listening. It's nice to have the book as a companion, but you don't actually have to own the book. It's free. And you get served up some content every single day just to sort of help you see how you can fit some of these habits into your daily life and videos about how to do some of the tests and the practices. So, you know, anyone who's curious, I say, you know, go check that out and join and see if you feel better at the end.
And if I may, last thing is, if you're listening to this podcast, we're not talking to you. You're already changed. You're already the crazy person in your neighborhood. Bring your family or friends along with you. That's where we see how we'll actually get out of this craziness is that we have a single person who acts as a power node and they bring along one friend. You have one uncle, you have one auntie, one person is your neighbor, someone in your household. That's how we change. It doesn't happen top down. It happens bottom up at this grassroots level. So if you're listening to this, you are already the change we're hoping to see and to make. I mean, you are we don't need to preach to you anymore. We're asking you to be that node, and Built to Move can be an easy resource for you to help someone else come along on your journey.
Beautiful. All right, everybody, let's go do that free challenge and be the change, right?
And also for everybody who's listening, you know, send this podcast to your friend and be that node and introduce them to the starettes who have been, you know, an untapped secret for many, many years. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you, Juliet. It's just such an honor.
Thank you guys so much for having us.
Thank you both.
Bye, you guys.
See you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for spending another week with us. Follow us at Uncharted Living Podcast on Instagram and TikTok. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And please like and share this episode with your favorite fellow human. Uncharted.